If you're experiencing difficulty, please reach out for support. You can reach QLife, an anonymous and free LGBTI support service, by calling 1800 184 527 or call Lifeline 24 hours a day on 131114 for crisis support and suicide prevention. In an emergency, please call 000.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, hosted by Lisa Dano Daniel. Coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Hi, you're listening to Word for Word, and I'm your host, Lisa Dano Daniel. Today's guest, Lindsay Kurilev, has been somewhat of an unsung hero amongst Melbourne's queer community for more decades than she would be happy to admit. Some highlights include managing the legendary Glasshouse Hotel, being heavily involved in the Also Foundation over a number of years, co-presenter at Joy, vice president and president of Bent TV, vice president of Victoria's Pride March, including MC of the main stage for well over a decade, and many more that we'll tease out during the next hour. 2020 proved to be a hugely challenging year for Lindsay when a major health battle changed her life forever. Welcome to Word for Word, Lindsay Kurilev.
Ah, thank you. Good to see you again, Lisa, after
Thanks
lockdown and everything.
I know it's been, look, we will talk about 2020 because it's been very challenging, and 21.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to your past a fair bit.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to find out about young Lindsay.
Yes.
So let's start at the very start. Where were you born? Are you Melbourne born and bred?
I am Melbourne born and bred, and the hospital no longer exists because it was the Queen Victoria Hospital, which is now a shopping centre. My earlier years were spent in Collingwood because my father died before I was born as a result of a car crash. So I basically live with my grandparents and my mother in Collingwood. And yeah, then my mother married, and I ended up growing up in Williamstown on Nelson Place, which was rather lovely because Port Phillip Bay was my front yard. Went to Williamstown South State School, number 1183, which I remember. Yeah, so it was nice growing up there. I was sort of the crazy kid that was always in the Seaman Missions op shop down the street and always wore really crazy clothes because that's where I was clothing myself from, you know, and the books. I always remember vividly one wall in that shop was just books, you know, from floor to ceiling, and just sitting there, and because I just sit there and sniff the books and read them. You know, so yeah, so it was nice growing up there. It's not like it is now. It was like a country town that was 10 minutes from the city.
Yeah, it's been gentrified a fair bit since.
Oh, yeah, it's terrible. And going back there after years of not living there, and of course my first relationship was very, very local. It was with Libby, and her parents had the Steam Packet Hotel. It was all very local until probably when we moved out. Look, even when we first bought our first property, it was in Williamstown, you know. School, I was an absolute chatterbox. I was actually very bright when I was at school, believe it or not.
You know, I can believe that.
Yeah, I was always sort of in that top section. I won a scholarship. It was interesting. I'm very lucky to have grown up in Williamstown back then because it was a country town that was really, really close to the city.
Because it wasn't somewhere that you had to drive through to go somewhere else.
Mm.
Like it was, you know, off to the left of Melbourne, like over the bridge. Or there wasn't a bridge then when you were
No. And actually when the bridge was actually completed, people were saying, oh, you can actually get out of the western suburbs now. You know, like, I don't know how people
like it was
think.
Alcatraz or something.
Yeah, it sort of was like that sort of English colloquial thinking, you know, like we'll go on a holiday, but we'll just go to the town next door. There was the punt, which was absolutely fascinating. Like you drive your car onto the punt and then all us kids would get out and, you know, put our hand over the chains. It was dragging this thing across the Yarra and it made this hideous noise.
There's still a punt, but just for bicycles.
Because the original punt, the local lads went down one night when they were drunk and they sunk it, you know. So there was the punt. So we did actually have access to the outside world, you know, outside of Williamstown and Newport. But you're absolutely right. It wasn't the place where you drove through to get anywhere. You actually went to Williamstown because you're going, and even now you go to Williamstown because you're going to Williamstown to eat, do whatever. Even older, like I said, you know, getting a cab, they'd just dump you off at Newport and have to walk the rest of the way home because they knew they'd never get a fare.
Now, take me back to your dad. So he died while your mother was pregnant.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you know much about him? Did your mum talk about him much when you were little?
I know heaps about him and lucky enough to know some of his friends because my mother was actually the manager of what would be now Art House Cinemas around Melbourne. And what she used to have to do at night is get the films because people would steal these films. And so when all the cinema houses are closed down, she had to collect the cans, take them back to this central point. And my dad would meet her. And my mum, and we were talking about about this on the way over. Like, my mum and my dad would go to Val's Cafe, and my mother openly says, oh, we just throw the poofs and the lezos in the back of the car and go to a party. You know, my dad actually went to took my grandfather, and my grandfather laughed about this story, but he didn't laugh at the time. You know, my mother was working, and so my father has picked up my grandpa to take him out for a drink, and he took him to some gay bar that I think that was on Swanson Street as well. And my grandfather said to him, he's saying, Michael, and my father was Ukrainian. My grandfather's saying to my dad, oh, you know, Michael, this is a gay bar. And my dad just turned around and said, yes, I know, and they love me, and just, you know, sashayed down the stairs. And that was my grandfather's first, you know, visit to a gay bar as well. They were very, very bohemian. Yeah, incredibly bohemian. He was the type of guy that wanted to know everything. You know, he drove like a maniac, and it was really interesting because he died in a car crash, but it was nowhere near his fault. You know, the guy that hit him was actually drunk. So it was really, really sad. And you know, one of the things that we were actually saying again on the way in is that, you know, as a little embryo, I would have been out visiting all these gay bars with my parents. So, you know, who knows? It might have rubbed up. Yeah, exactly.
Nurturing going on.
Yeah.
Well, he sounds like a pretty amazing character. And I, you know, surely there's aspects of his personality that live on in you. Mm. How old were you when your mother remarried?
I was about 3.5.
Yeah. I know you don't want to talk about that. Yeah, and it wasn't a pleasant relationship, obviously.
No, look, it was one of those situations. Stepfather, he also was Ukrainian, totally different from my father. I don't know whether different parts of Ukraine or whatever. I've never really researched that. But he was just a really nasty man. And he had a son. And, you know, and I think it happens in a lot of families where there are stepkids that, you know, the kids that, you know, the original kids or whatever, sort of forgotten. And I sort of fall in, you know, into that. And I think that put me in good stead because, you know, when I was very little, I used to go, what is it, the Williamstown Light Opera Company was around then. So after school, I'd go there and paint sets and things like that. And my mother would say, you know, where have you been? I've been, you know, at the Williamstown Light Opera Company. And she'd be, oh, no, you haven't, you know. And I'd be, I'd say, I have been. But, you know, Alex could do anything, you know. And it was weird. It was weird growing up in like that, but it gave me a lot of independence. It actually gave me a lot of freedom as well to sort of walk around, especially in Williamstown, getting back to that, walking around Williamstown, falling in love with architecture. I drive people mad with, you know, talking about architecture and just being able to be me in so many ways.
You still got your mum?
It was her birthday last week, actually. She was 89 and she started to be a little bit, you know, losing it a little bit.
As you do at 89, I guess.
Yeah, but, you know, and our relationship now is great. I think anyone that comes from a background like mine, you go through all these phases and then at the end of it, you just think, hey, you know, that's the way that life is. At the end of the day, she's still my mother. You know, I may not like her or like so many things about her, but I really respect where she's come from and I understand what happened to her in her life. And we get along a lot better now.
We sort of do the best with the tools we've got and we're the product of our generation. So I love your attitude that, you know, what's in the past is in the past and we do the best with what we've got and let's just get on with it.
Yeah, exactly.
We touched on school a little bit and it sounds to me that, like, you're almost like an only child or, you know, like you sort of got to do whatever you like. So were you a popular kid at school?
No, not at all. I think at high school I was, but at primary school, no, because where I grew up, geographically, I was so removed from other kids, so there were no other kids for me to interact with. And I think, you know, perhaps I might have been really lonely or something at primary school because I just seemed to go to the library all the time. I loved the library and I loved the art room. And I had a few sort of friends, but no one that I really hung out with on the weekend or anything like that. So my weekends were very much during summer and even winter down the beach, painting in the backyard. We had this huge backyard and then we got a pool. I mean, we live so close to the, you know, the beach anyway, we had to have a pool. You know, I did have some friends, but it wasn't, yeah, again, because I was so geographically removed, there were no other kids around me. I just sort of made the best of it.
And did that continue into high school or did sort of things change as you got older?
Oh, no, when I got into high school, I was incredibly political.
Where can you get that from?
Where do I get that from?
Yeah, Mum?
To a certain extent, because my mother has this really keen sense of justice and injustice. Apparently my dad was very political and very artistic and creative, and he sort of would, when it came to politics, apparently spent a lot of time with my grandmother talking politics. So it could come from there, but I think it sort of came from Williamstown. There was a lot of old money in Williamstown, but it was still very much a working class suburb. And one of the things was in my school that we received a lead because we were always getting the dregs of what the education department saw as the dregs of the education system. And yet these women were so out there. They were ahead of their time. Most of our teachers were incredibly ahead of their time. We had one English teacher that would bring in a Bob Dylan record and sit us down and say, right, I want you to listen to this. I want you to have a look at what's going on politically around us. Because Victoria, when I was a teenager, was really, there was a lot of unrest. Anyway, so we'd listen to Bob Dylan, like Blowing in the Wind. Now, how do we relate that to what's going on now? And wow, that's how I was taught to think. So these teachers who were seen as being, you know, the absolute dregs of the education society, they were just absolute, they were gods. They were really encouraging if you sort of had a little bit of a political sway. Like there was one revolution that I led and I got the school skeleton. I can't remember what the issue was, but got the school skeleton, dressed it up in the uniform and went running around all the classes, like bringing people out that were going to follow our cause. Stuff like that. We actually got a letter from the Premier, I can't remember his name now, but in this letter, reading between the lines, it was basically saying that our school was full of girls that by the age of 16 would be having illegitimate children, and basically there was no sense in educating us. And that really, really like hit a chord. Our headmistress actually read that letter out and it really sort of hit a chord. And I think that sense of like, you know, no, we're entitled as much as anybody. And even now I think this way, you know, when governments cut funds for education, health, no, you don't do that. You just don't do it. Education is so important. So I was a bit of a rebel at high school. Quite popular. If anything needed doing, he sort of came to me.
Because that could have gone either way. Getting a letter like that and having the school principal read it out, that could have either forced kids to go, to sort of cower under it and go, oh, we're not good enough, so we're just going to keep quiet and not say anything. Or do what you did, and I'm assuming a few raconteurs joined you, and, you know, stand up against that sort of stuff speak your mind.
Yeah, and I think that after that letter and after some of the things that we endured at that school, I don't know if there'd be very many Liberal voters in my class or my year. I think that we sort of grew up with that knowing that politicians is, you know, sometimes just are very nasty people.
Are you in touch with anyone from high school years?
Oh, yes, yeah. A few actually, and thanks to Facebook that we've reconnected, and we generally have a reunion probably about once every 5 years.
Really,
and that's really interesting because all the gangs sort of come back together as they used to be at school, and you know, and I'm still seen as a bit of a renegade and all the rest. And of course, being gay, you know, when I sort of told them, oh yeah, we sort of knew something like that, you know.
Are you the only gay in the village?
Yeah. Well, no, there was three, four of us back then that we know of.
Yeah, you know, you didn't know at the time.
Always. Yeah. You know, I'm one of those people that sort of, I don't know, was sort of the arty one or whatever, and just sort of, you know, being gay was like, oh yeah, see, I'm gay, and just sort of got on with it. But I was also very fortunate that two of my closest friends, Richard and Franchek, they owned the boutique in Williamstown called Utopia, and I worked for them, and they were gay. So me sort of, you know, that coming out thing, it never really happened for me. It was just like, oh yeah, this is where I'm meant to be, so, you know, off I went.
So you didn't have any sort of, you know, coming out to your mum?
No.
It was just the way it was?
Just the way it was.
It's pretty unusual for that era. Because let's place you in a decade. Give me the decade that you were born in, just to give the listeners
50s,
an idea. In
the 56.
50s. So that's you know, you're pretty young then, obviously. That's a reasonably unusual story that I get in here. It's mostly, not always, but there's quite often a bit of angst about someone in their 60s coming out in the time that you did. But perhaps it's a benefit of where you lived at the time, where you grew up, and having artistic parents.
Yeah, it could have been a, you know, relatively artistic mother. But, you know, I never sort of came out to my mother. I just sort of naturally assumed that people knew, you know. And I actually said this to John Wayne one night. A guy tried to pick me up at Metro Gallery. And I was really astounded at this. And we went to the market after. I was talking to John Wayne. And I was saying, John, how did he not know that I was gay? And he said, well, you just look really arty, you know.
Arty.
Like, arty. And I sort of arty. And I thought, no, I don't. I must look gay, you know. And I sort of wanted this thing, no, I must look gay. You know, I need to look gay. I need to sort of, you know, identify through my clothing or something that I really am a dyke. But, yeah, I just honestly, I've never had, the only time I had really hardcore homophobia directed at me was at Carol's death, and that was probably the worst time. And once when I was walking across Johnson Street from Brunswick Street, and I was holding hand with, you know, my then whatever. These guys yelled that, you know, you lesbians. And I laughed because that was the first time it ever happened. And I said, can you spell it? You know, and they just put their head in, wound up the window, and that was the end of that.
So there was nothing amongst your friends. It was more complete strangers.
Yeah.
That were, you know, and it sounds pretty rare. Mm. I once had my tarot cards read not that long ago by a woman at a market, and she sort of looked at me and she said, oh, you're married with two kids and you're a nurse. And I thought, are you blind? Are you also blind? Because you obviously can't read tarot cards. I thought, yes, it's clearly blind. Now, what did you want to do when you were at school? Did you have any aspirations about what you were going to do when you finished high school?
Oh, yes. I always wanted to be a writer. I wanted to write. And it was something that I was very, very good at when I was at school. And I also wanted to join Andy Warhol's factory. And that seemed to be the two big things that I really wanted to do with my life. And then I think we all as kids have these fantasies of running away. You know, some people want to join the Navy, but I wanted to go to New York and be with Andy Warhol and Lou Reed. And I think I was probably the youngest Lou Reed fan out there. And of course, you know, the drummer, Maureen being a woman and all this, like that was all, you know, just fantastic to me. And I don't know if kids now have show and tell, you know, when you used to have to stand up in front of the class and, you know, you'd show a shell that you found down the beach that weekend. And, you know, my show and tell was, oh, look, you know, Andy Warhol's brilliant. so many times my teachers just say, oh, look, it's all right. You know, and I think what they were saying, I don't think they understand what you're talking about, just sit down. So, yeah, that was my two big aspirations. And then, you know, when I was a teenager, then there was that big one that, you know, I think most surfy kids wanted to do is get a combi and go around Australia. There was that one. Like in my early 20s, I just wanted to escape Australia. I just didn't want to live here anymore. And I ended up, you know, still living here. But, yeah, it was just this thing I just wanted to get out of here.
Was that sort of romantic thing about leaving what was comfortable or some sort of sense of adventure about, you know,
better architecture was one thing.
Like to Spain or something like that.
Yeah, Spain, Paris, Italy, like there was Europe. And even now, having, you know, lived in London for only 6 months, but Europe is so romantic, you know, on so many levels. And you know, when you sit down for a coffee in Paris, you know, people are nicely dressed. You know what I mean? There's a sense of style. There's tradition. There's food and all this. And I think maybe it's just something that's in my blood from having a European father. I don't know. But I just love Europe. I always know where I'm going when I'm in Europe.
Have you been to the Ukraine?
No, I have no. I think Ukrainian people are basically quite mad by what I've seen.
Well, based on your experience, yes, that's probably true.
Yeah, they seem to be very, very artistic. Ukrainian people seem to love woodwork and writing poetry and singing songs of the homeland. So when you're with a lot of Ukrainian people, I think it's like anybody out there that has grown up with ethnic parents, like when they get together and they've had a few vodkas and they start singing songs of the homeland and you could swim in the tears. But then it's, you know, bloody Ukraine, you know, not a shit country, you know, we better here. Why we do this? And then they sort of pack up and go home, you know. And I remember as a kid, you know, these people would be drinking straight vodka, right, with a beer chaser and then stand up and just walk. And then when I got older and I was watching people get drunk, they're all over the place. Then I realised, like, they'd have something to eat, you know, like a varaniki or a pickled cucumber or something, and then down with the vodka and then the beer. So all that food was just absorbing the alcohol and they just walk out and drive. I'd hate to think now what the readings would be of those people. But, yeah, you know, away we should have left Ukraine before the war. What do we do?
So talk me through your first few jobs after you left school. Mm. So you wanted to be a writer, and I know you still write, and we'll get to that a bit later.
When I first left school, I was working for Richard Franchek, so I was sort of window dressing there. They had about five shops at that stage, so I was going around and, you know, window dressing their shops. And then I thought, my parents made it quite clear that they would not support me when I went to university, so I thought, okay. So I ended up window dressing at Darryl Lee's. That was my first, you know, full-time job. I worked in Coles part-time. Myself and my friend were sacked because we were giving away lots of stuff to the elderly people, you know, the pensioners.
There's like a sense of social justice again.
Yeah, like they'd say, oh, you know, oh, darling, you know, we just want a light bulb. We'd give them six, you know. Yeah. And then they decide they'd put us on the cordial counter. Like they had these cordial counters and we had to make up cordial. And so you had to put in like one shot of cordial, and so we'd put in three shots, so it was a nice green colour for them. So anyway, the boss got wind of that and basically sacked us on the spot.
What
and,
a surprise.
Yeah, so I was walking down the street and I went to visit Richard, and I said, I've just been sacked, Richard, you know, and he's like, why? So when I told him, he said, well, you can come work for me after school and Saturdays, you know, so that was great. Realising I, you know, I'd have to find somewhere to live and all that and study. That didn't sort of suit me. I just wanted to, I don't know, live some bohemian life or something. So I ended up a window dresser at Darrell Lee's, and that was a bit of fun. The tickets, you know, because back in those days they were handwritten tickets, and the ticket writer was actually this old dyke that would sit in the Swanson Street store upstairs. It was like totally dark except for her little desk, and she was sort of like, one time she'd be really grumpy and you'd see her 5 minutes later and she'd be all over you like a rash, like she was just this really weird lesbian. And then I realised that a lot of lesbians were that weird, you know, so, you know, she was a good introduction. I decided to study or do something, and I found out that at the taxation office you could get study leave. I thought, oh, yeah, I'll be a public servant. That means I can study. So anyway, I got a job at the taxation office. But then I found out that you had to actually study something that was relevant to taxation, like accounting or something like that. And I thought, oh, shit, you know, what am I going to do about this? So I actually said, you know, on my application for study leave, I wrote something like that, something about media and the taxation office and, you know, being a like a PA or something for the deputy commissioner and, you know, my, you know, media studies are going to come in handy, all this. And anyway, they allowed it in the end. So I used to get 3 half days off a week, and I only had classes like 2 half days. The other half day would be down the beach or the NGV or, you know, just, you know, filling in a bit of time.
So what were you studying?
I was studying media studies. And I went to Swinburne and also Footscray Tech.
So practical stuff like, you know, making films or
No, because I wanted to – this was my other sort of thing that I would have liked to have got into a lot more than what I eventually did was advertising. I always loved advertising. And I had a couple of partners that said, why do you talk during the film and then watch the ads? And that's what I used to do. I did a little bit of you know, studio stuff, and I just loved it. And I sort of made a big mistake when I was at Swinburne that I should have actually gone more into the like tech side than the creative side, but it all sort of panned out at the end because I ended up doing nothing with it. You know?
You sort of did. I mean, you've had a fair
Well, I used it in you know, community media, but by that stage it had sort of changed a bit as well because I was like late teens, early 20s when I was doing this, and then I decided that I think it was English Lit that I actually absolutely loved, so I went back and did English Lit a couple of times and just didn't sit the exams just to read the book. It was great because at Swinburne they just covered everything, and there was a friend of mine who was she was doing her HSC, so I actually used to sit on a couple of her classes. They didn't know one of them was English Lit. Oh right, you know, so you're reading Macbeth again, great, you know. And I wrote a few essays for her, so that sort of panned out well.
That'd be cheating now, Lindsay.
It would be now, wouldn't it?
It
would be frowned on in society these days. Anyway, so when I got there I realised I sort of should have done more of the tech side, you know, things like that. It stood me in good stead for our work later on.
You're listening to Word for Word, and I'm chatting to Lindsay Kurilev. So how did you discover the queer community?
Oh, you really want to know that.
I do. Because what I want to get to is how you got involved in it as well. Like, it's one thing to go along to things like I do, but you got heavily involved as well. So how did you find it?
How did I find it?
How did you know it existed?
I think I'd been at the taxation office for about 2 weeks, and I remember it being the day that they actually okayed my study leave. So it was all done very, very quickly. And I was with a girl from school, from work. We were in Coles on Bourke Street. That's how long ago it was. I see this guy that was a 5-minute boyfriend when I was in grade 3. You know, oh, hi, how you going? And I thought, oh, my God, he's gay. You know, because he was like, oh, hi, how you going? You know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, he said, what are you doing on the weekend? And I, oh, nothing. So he invited me to the Dover Hotel. On Saturday nights there was a drag show, and I thought, yeah, why not? Anyway, so my work friend said no, that she wasn't going to any gay venue. I don't know who I dragged along. It was some school friend. I said, come on, we're going out to this gay venue, and that was it. I sort of dumped the you know, straight school friend and just had fun.
I think you're the first person ever in here to link the tax department to their discovery of the queer community, I have to say. You're the first.
It was well, probably it also, the last. Well, it all sort of happened on the same day. Second week of tax, getting my study leave approved, and then bang, walking into Coles and there's the gay community, and, you know, I was just into it from then on.
Life change. What decade is this?
This would have been the 70s.
Tell me about the gay community, the queer community in the 70s?
Golly, it's going back a long way. I remember it being an awful lot of fun. I remember the camaraderie, there was a lot more compassion amongst gay people. Like if somebody was in need, other people seemed to rush there. Instead of now, I've seen, especially during, you know, the AIDS crisis, I saw some disgusting behaviour then, and that really rocked me because it was not my my background in the community. It was sort of a time where I think so many of us went out on our own, and when we walked into these venues, we knew everybody there. You know,
so it was like an alternative family.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, come Saturday night, Friday night, you'd dress up. You never wore the same thing twice. Always had a change of clothing in the car, you know, because you went off to a party, you didn't want to look the same, always gel and a bit of spritz and stuff like that. But, yeah, I remember it being really good fun. And then Isabella's opened and Annabelle's, and there was just this constant stream just up the street from here. And people would be going, you know, like walking along the street, and people would be coming back from Annabelle's. Oh, what's Annabelle's like? Oh, it's really horrible. All right, we'll turn around and go back. And then sometimes you wouldn't believe, and you get to Annabelle's and it'd be fantastic. There was this thing. Then after that, we'd go to Mrs. Vans on Turak Road or the Electro Doghouse. And Mrs. Vans was great because she'd sort of sell all this gourmet, like after venue food. And like the Electro Doghouse, that was hot dogs, you know, so you'd always have a big hot dog, couple of dim sims. And then there was always a party, and you'd always be given a slip of paper. And the person giving you that paper would say, oh, look, I really like you. You can come to this party, but don't tell anyone else. So somebody there would say, oh, what are you doing after here? What are you doing after Isabella's? Oh, nothing. Oh, but I'm going to this party. So by the time you got to these parties, like there were thousands of people. And there's one really memorable New Year's Eve. And I think we'd been to Isabella's or something like that. And it was actually the last time I ever wore a dress socially because we'd been out for dinner. And I'm in this, I can't remember, I think it was a Carla Zampatti dress and scarf. And this great big hat and, you know, shoes and all the rest of it. And we'd been out for this New Year dinner. Then we end up at Isabella's. And then after that, a lot of people out there around my vintage will remember the terraces were where St Kilda Junction is now. And there were these three-story terraces. And the kids that lived there would always have a party on a Saturday night. Or if they weren't having a party, we'd just end up having a party there anyway. This particular New Year's Eve, we have Lloyd on the roof of Robert's car. The car is full of people. I don't know how many people were there. There used to be this amazing character called Fluff, and she was punk before it was punk, and she was just the most amazing character. Anyway, we come down Flinders Street, and we're turning into Swanston Street, and, you know, there's people everywhere. This is like, I don't know, maybe 1976 or something. There's people everywhere, and Lloyd's hanging onto the roof of the car, and Robert's actually squirting him with the little boys, and all of a sudden we hear these whistles and these voices because we know he's going slow around the corner because there's lots of people, and the police have pulled us up. The glory of all this was when Fluff fell out of the car, all her comment was that her clairvoyant told her she was going to be raped by a man in uniform, so she just lifted up her skirt, you know, in the middle of the street, and the police are like, no, put it down, put it down. So we got Lloyd off the roof, and we actually had a police escort to this party.
Wouldn't happen now.
Would never, ever, ever happen now. So when we got out of the car, honestly, Lisa, I don't know how many people in the car. There could have been 10, 12 people in this whole new age. When we rolled up at the party, bodies just fell out, and the boys all ran to the fence to relieve themselves, and the police said we could actually fine them for that, and they just went, oh, and they just walked off. But, yeah, we actually had a police escort. So that was the times. You know, I know people that were pulled up by the police. They'd have too much to drink. They'd take their car, their keys, sorry. They'd give them the address where the car would be in the morning and come and pick it up. You just wouldn't get that now. You know, it's just, it's all changed, of course. Getting back to the gay thing, it was this big family and we all knew each other. There were lots of parties, like Sundays there'd be luncheons, and then Sundays, you know, when pokies open, we'd be at pokies. Then there was Jan's Dances, you know, and Penny's. I think I was about 14 when I was going to Spangles and Jan's Dances, which were just a hoot because all these people, you know, all dressed up. And I actually remember the first time I saw these two guys kissing, and they were dressed as Dracula, both of them. It was some special function. And I was just like this, you know, like watching them. And they looked at me and I said, oh, look, sorry, I've just never seen boys kiss before. I'm, you know, just a bit new to all this, you know. And they were like, oh, yeah, fair enough. But, you know, these days, be, oh, no, you're, you know, infringing my rights to be, you know, it's all bullshit now, to be honest. But, yeah, it was so totally different and so much freedom that, you know, kids now and like we just don't have.
Do you think a lot of that was a result of a lot of queers at the time having lost contact with their family because they've been rejected or, you know, that was their only family because their actual biological family didn't, you know, had rejected them because they were gay? Do you think there was a bit of that going on?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely, definitely. And we knew, you know, it could be at lunch or anywhere where you could hold a conversation, and that was always, you know, there'd always be somebody there who'd been trying to contact their parents again or had heard that a parent had died. And I think the thing was that because we were so strong, and I think, you know, when I look back then, I think that even where we were at, we're probably politically stronger than what we are now, that they did sort of seek refuge or companionship, whatever it was. You know, like when you're at venues and things like that, you don't get to talk to people. You know, like we're all just there for the fun of it. And then, you know, you'd see these people who are absolutely great fun and great to be around, and then you'd meet them at lunch and, you know, there would always come the sad story time of the luncheon, and they'd tell you their story. So you're absolutely right in thinking that they did seek a family within the community.
Yeah, like an inbuilt security blanket, I guess. So how did you, in the introduction I talked about, you know, all the contributions you've made in terms of Joy, this radio station, Bent TV, the Also Foundation.
It goes on and on and on.
You know, there's a lot of stuff that you've done. How did you become involved in a formal sense? And what was the first organisation you got involved with?
I was actually invited. I was always invited to do all this. I was never anything I did voluntarily, because I always saw community. I always saw that there were the community folk and then there were us sort of raver folk, and they never really mixed. You know, there was this sort of, you know, huge highway down the middle of our community that, you know, and I'd sort of look at some of these community people and think, oh, my God, you know, can you smile? Can you, you know, if you're going to represent me, especially, you know, some of the lesbians, you know, if you're going to represent me, can you have a shower at least? You know, throw on a bit of Avon perfume, I'd be happy.
4711.
Oh, 7-Eleven, yeah, 4711, yeah. So anyway, I was working in the finance industry, and I was invited by the Also Care Board to be the treasurer.
Yep.
You know, and I think, oh God, you know, oh yeah, I'll do this, you know. So, and I was in a relationship at the time. I thought I'd give a bit of time on her own. All that, you know.
So
being very kind and generous.
Were you accepted? Because also, just tell us a little bit about what the Also Foundation was first before I ask the next question.
Oh, my God. How would you define the Also Foundation? The Also Foundation,
because it stood for the Alternative Lifestyle Organisation,
yeah,
didn't it? And it was set up, correct me if I'm wrong, for as a support network for gay men.
And lesbians. Yeah, it was really interesting how they actually got their name, because they didn't want, and I think this is probably the best thing that Also ever did, was they didn't want to be openly gay, because they'd be, you know, we would, you know, thinking back, when did the Also Foundation start? Maybe
70s? Yeah, I was going to say 70s.
Yeah.
Mac Ronan, was one of the key figures. He was my sociology lecturer at uni.
Oh, wow.
And he had an Also ring.
Yeah.
And I used to wonder what the hell that was. And when I found out what it was, I was so impressed that he would wear this ring, even though it was, you know, it wasn't obvious as to what it was. But, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. You know, it was all very cloak and dagger. And even in the early days, you know, it also was quite cloak and dagger, because you had to be. So calling a gay organisation Alternate Lifestyle was brilliant, because this is an alternate lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, to mainstream, our lifestyle is alternate. You know, let's face it.
Yeah, it still is.
Yeah. Thank God for that.
Although less so, I guess, in some ways. Like, it's like, what are your thoughts on, you know, obviously we've got equal marriage now. What are your thoughts on the way that some gay and lesbian couples seem to just have adopted a straight lifestyle? Like,
oh,
you know, they're having weddings and getting married and having kids and doing what many of us see as a straight lifestyle.
I'd like to know, at what point did we become so bloody conservative?
And mainstream, I guess.
And mainstream. And, you know, that's what we want. We want to be part of society. And I think I actually mentioned this years ago on Bent TV, but we need an identity as much as any other group out there. So while we slip into mainstream and we want, you know, I went to a dinner party and these lesbians were talking about splashbacks. And I'm thinking, you know, like once upon a time it'd be, you know, a little bit more political or even a little bit of gossip I would have been helpful.
I've had chats about splashbacks, Lindsay.
Yeah, but at a dinner party with other people, like when you're meant to be, you know what I mean? Like it did my head in. You know, we've become incredibly conservative. And okay, that might be a good thing, it might be a bad thing, or it's just a thing. You know, that's it. It is just a thing. But to think how outrageous we were and how brave we were and everything else that we were even 20 years ago, you know, like we've just sort of sunken into this, you know, suburban hole. And now it is, it's splashbacks, babysitters, you know, 2.5 Fords in the driveway, you know, a white picket fence, and everything's going to be hunky-dory. And the same-sex marriage, I was absolutely, ridiculed, abused, because I don't understand heterosexual marriage. You know, what's the sense in it? If you love someone, you're with them. Have some little commitment ceremony, something like that. But all this stuff that's based around marriage, well, I was absolutely crucified for having that opinion. And I'm saying, look, if you want to get married, yeah, the option should be there. What's so different about us that we're not allowed to get married? You know, God didn't say anything about gay people. Jesus didn't say anything about gay people. This stuff has all been made up. So if you want to get married, go out and just get married. You know, don't listen to what everybody else is saying. I know you can't do that, because to me that's worse than just being inactive or sitting around, you know, oh, I want to get married but I can't. Just go out and do it. And I, you know, in one conversation I had with people years ago, I said, listen, the more of us that just go out and ring celebrants and say, hey, we want to get married, the ball will be rolling then anyway. So by the time that this does appear in Parliament, we can say, oh, yeah, well, the figures show that, you know, X amount of gay people have already got married. I look at what they've contributed financially. They all, you know, 80% of them hold mortgages, yada, yada, yada. You know, there's always another way. But, you know, and I think it's with every community, we seem to go like gung-ho into something and we don't have plan B. And that's one thing that worried me about the same-sex bill, is that we did not have plan B. If they had said, oh, no, a lot of people would have just gone, you know, well, what's the sense? Mm. And that, I think, was more dangerous. But, yeah, when did we become so bloody conservatives that splashbacks, babysitters, and, you know, it's no more, you know, the stuff we used to get up to.
I understand what you're saying, because, you know, marriage is a legal document. And it has a very patriarchal history in terms of, you know, ownership of a woman and that sort of history. And, you know, I understand, you know, why do we want to imitate that? Why don't we, if you want to do it, do it. But perhaps why don't we invent something of our own? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah.
So
I mean, it happened. I mean, I was really pleased. I shed a little tear. It was just such a move forward for our community. But at the same time, I was like, oh, God, you know, more conversation about splashbacks and babysitters.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, I haven't been to many queer weddings, but it seems like it's just, you know, we're just reproducing a straight wedding or a straight marriage.
Yeah.
Interesting. Look, it's an interesting chat. We could talk about it all day.
Yeah.
You were also, so you were involved for a long time. You would have seen some pretty heady days there in terms of the AIDS crisis and difficulties of keeping a not-for-profit organisation open, lots of politics, dance parties and the demise of those. Were you around during those times?
Oh, hell yeah. It was interesting times. And look, I'll tell it like it is. The problem with our community sometimes is misogyny. And there were times where I sat on the Also Care board and these guys would just talk over you. There were certain men that would just talk over you. So we were just there, I think, as token dykes to make it, you know, look fabulous. And then along comes AIDS and it was terrible. You know, I don't know. You know, I nursed quite a number of friends to their death, you know, there for their last breath. I don't know how these gay guys out there have survived it with the amount of friends that they lost and very, very close friends, you know, this family that they lost. And it just seemed to be go, go, go. But the interesting thing was that if somebody had a different opinion to somebody else, like somebody said, look, I think we should do this, I think we should approach that person, you know, there were heady arguments, but it all managed to stay together. The AIDS crisis itself, I think, was the glue. And no matter what your opinion was, like even as women, you know, like, oh, can we do this, can we do that, you know, there were guys out there that were absolute misogynists that we knew, you know, because we've been out for lunch with them and things like that. The interesting thing was that they were the guys that had carers who were lesbians. And, you know, I know of one case, and this guy to his last week was, oh, I hate dogs. Well, what am I, you know, my friend said, well, what am I doing here looking after you? And he says, oh, I love you. I'm going to tell you now I love you. It was weird because you could never take anything that anyone was saying because you'd know that somebody was HIV, if they got really nasty, maybe it was affecting their mind. But the wonderful thing was that the community banded together and everything else, well, this was my view of it, everything else was just forgotten and bang, we got through it. And some amazing things happened throughout that period. And yes, we've got the Also Foundation to thank. We've also got, you know, Victorian AIDS Council to thank. You know, housing, they set up a housing group pretty well immediately. And I actually had a friend who did a PhD on our community and how quickly, if there's a call to action, how quickly we act. Because we basically, well, in those days, we had a group for everything. If you're like a one-legged lesbian, there'd be a group for you. At the end of the day, this amazing community is just together. And that's what, I think we should be very proud of that.
Maybe we should be running the COVID vaccine.
Well, I think so. Lisa, absolutely.
Hit the ground running?
Yeah.
No stuffing around?
No. Well, look at the botch up that it is. I mean, how easy is it really to import and then line people up and inject? I mean, to me, it's not rocket science. It's really, really simple. You know, hire a flat somewhere, you know what I mean?
Like I said, put the lesbians in charge and we'll sort it out.
Oh, absolutely.
So you mentioned before that you've lost a few friends through HIV. You lost the great Shane Bridges a couple of years ago, and you mentioned Carol.
Yes.
Can we talk about the loss of a partner?
Oh, it's hard.
How long were you together?
Look, we were on and off for 4 years. It was one of those, it was sort of like a past life catch up or something because we did not know where we knew each other from. Like, she came up to my offices and we were looking at each other and she's looking at me and I'm looking at her and I'm thinking, where do I know her from? And was thinking, where do I know me from? So the next day we went down to Brunswick Street and we sat in Cafe Retro for about 6 hours trying to see if I was in Paris the same time she was and it just didn't, it was just...
You never figured it out.
We never, ever figured it out. And then there was this toing and froing, you know, like she was a Capricorn, I was a Taurine. It's two really strong, you know, headed people getting together and all this other stuff in between. We didn't want anybody, you know, every time we would go out together, somebody from Bent TV would see us coming up the stairs together. Ah, what have you two been doing? And it was like, you know, it puts the kibosh on everything. So toing and froing. 2nd of January, and I was down at the Prince of Wales, as you do, you know, the day after New Year's Day, and, you know, with some friends, and Carol was there, and she was a mess. She'd started drinking again, just an absolute mess, and there would be no way that I would leave someone, you know, and we hadn't spoken to each other for about 6 months before this. So when she saw me, it was that sort of, you know, that lesbian, you know, that look. And then, you know, she just basically fell up into my arms and just said that, Tommy, you know, no uncertain terms, just how screwed up she really was. So the next day we planned to meet because she forgot about that because she was really drunk. Got her sober. Everything was going well. I was managing the glass house. Her mother, we were actually going to the Dinah Shore weekend in LA.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, and we were going to do that.
Great big lesbian hangout.
Yeah.
For those who don't know.
Yeah. So we were so looking forward to that. She rang her mother to tell her that, you know, we're coming to the States and we wanted to catch up, yada, yada, yada. And she had an aunt in Georgia and Carol just really wanted me to go to Georgia. And I was like, oh, yeah, I really want to go to Georgia, you know. We're ready to go. She talks to her mother and her mother tells her to not come anywhere near the house. She doesn't want her there, that she's nothing but a junkie. Oh, it was just terrible. And that was it. Carol just plummeted basically. So as much as, you know, there was been no way I'd leave any human being in that state. You know, we had these fabulous times together. We went away together on holidays and stuff. And then she came back to Melbourne and again, she spoke to her mum and her mum said, no, don't come anywhere near the house. And that was it. She took to drinking. She tried to kill herself, got her into a rehab unit and she had an overdose of heroin in rehab and she'd just gone there because she was drinking far too much Jim Beam.
Wow.
So, yeah, so it was just really weird. So there was just so much to process and then keep the glass house running because the police were trying to close the glass house down. I'm at 2 or 3 meetings a week with the Minister of Gaming and Licensing trying to keep the glass house open.
Why are they trying to close it?
Because of Roger, basically, and there was a little bit of politicking between a couple of other pubs. There was another pub that I went.
Roger,
I think
was
it's
the
called.
Owner?
Sorry?
Was Roger the owner?
Yeah. He was the owner. I think it was the Rochester. I don't think it operates anymore. But there was a bit of politicking going on. They wanted the glass house closed. When they knew that I was there, they upped the ante. They had spies. It was just really horrible.
For those who don't know the glass house, it was a very famous lesbian pub yeah. in Melbourne.
Yeah, pub. That was basically what it was, a pub.
It was your pool tables and your beers.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah.
Except when somebody was dating, you had to have champagne because, you know, they wanted to impress the new girlie. So, you know, Carol's in a mess. I'm trying to keep the Glasshouse Hotel open. Carol dies. I'm still trying to, you know, keep the pub open amidst all this. And, yeah, and then, what was his name? Rodney. He took over the pub and that was it. And it was interesting times because we, you know, there'd be times I'd go home and Carol wouldn't know who I was, you know, because Carol was also bipolar. So she's trying to sort of dry out. And as she's sort of drying out and taking, you know, this mix of medication, there were times I'd sort of get home at 6, 7 o'clock in the morning and, Carol, can you let me in? And she'd be, you know, who are you? It's me. You know, and that stuff's heartbreaking as well. We just had this amazing bond that no matter what, somebody asked me not so long back, would we have still been together? And the answer was just no. But we'd always be together, if you know what I mean. And in between girlfriends or whatever, we'd probably just, you know, gravitate and then, you know, argue again and then bang.
So sort of ships that kept meeting each other on the ocean, I suppose. Yeah. It's a bit of a cliche, but...
Yeah, and it was, but it was definitely some past life thing. And even now, you know, if Bang a Gong, you know, by T-Rex comes on, Carol's right there, you know, that was our song, so to speak. And you just feel her energy, even if I'm driving in the car. And for months after she died, you know, she'd be in the car with me. She was constantly in contact. And even sometimes now, like Bang a Gong comes on, you feel her energy. Sometimes I'll, you know, I might be watching TV or something and I'll just feel her there, and it's nice, you know. Yeah, it's nice. You know, that was 21 years ago now. But
I guess
the time,
they also stay with you. And it sounds like there was a bit of loss at that time with, you know, the struggle with the Glasshouse and then Carol.
Yeah.
Now, look, speaking of loss, I want to get round to the events of 2020 because we had COVID, obviously. Mm. But something happened in your life that was quite significant that has changed things for you significantly. Talk me through what happened to you last year, Lindsay. You've had type 2 diabetes.
Yep. I've had type 2 diabetes. And I also have this disease called Raynaud's, where if I get cold...
Cold extremities, is that?
Yeah. So if my hands get really, really cold, for example, there was one year they were so cold I couldn't do anything. I couldn't dress myself even. There was one night in Trentham, I thought, gee, my feet are so cold, I could not heat them up, right?
Come and home Trentham's from Trentham's a very cold place.
Oh, God, yeah, even in the middle of summer, which, you know, they have 3 hot days and it's all over Red Rover. I come back to Melbourne and I'm sitting on my laptop and the breeze, cold breeze is coming in because I love, you know, breeze and the windows are always opened. And I felt the cold get into my right foot. So I end up with a dose of plantar fasciitis, which is not unusual, which is really painful, and a splash of neuropathy. You know, the nerve, you know, you sort of go...
So nerve pain.
Nerve pain, yeah. Yep. But it sort of jolts. Then, you know, I was having treatments and I'm thinking, no, there's something really wrong with my foot here. I couldn't, you know, under normal circumstances, I'd go to my Chinese practitioner. Of course, we're in lockdown by this stage, can't, you know, go and see him. I found out later that I could as an emergency, too late. I couldn't see a doctor. You know, I was screaming in pain at night. You know, I had my head in my pillow screaming because the pain was so intense. I'm ringing doctors, any doctors willy-nilly. Look, I'm in incredible pain. No. We can give you Panadeine Forte for the pain, but because it's COVID-19, if I had heard COVID-19 one more time, I would have got bricks and just, you know, clanked them over their head. I ring hospitals. No. Unless you're dying, we cannot see you because of COVID-19. So I go to have the cortisone shot, and this guy says to me, oh, what are those 2 dots on your toes? I said, I don't know. I had this really bad pain in my foot, bad neuropathy. I actually had a foot spa and the water was just tepid and I just screamed in pain, and that's when these 2 little dots appeared. I thought it was, I don't know, chilblains or something like that. Saw my Chinese practitioner. He actually got the blood flowing again. So, you know, had I knew back, you know, earlier, could have probably saved it. So he sends me off to Williamstown Hospital. So I lay there for an afternoon. I got no idea what's going on. Then from there, I'm transported to Footscray Hospital. I lay in bed for about 4 or 5 weeks just watching my foot turn black. And every time they gave me a treatment, it was just too late. Like, I was hooked up to this drip and I said, guys, my foot's black. You know, I'm in pain. Whatever's going on here, this is too late. I'm telling the doctors this. And I think they were trying to cover their lazy backsides, to be honest. Then, you know, the doctor came in and said, we're going to have to amputate your leg. And I said, great. I just want this pain gone. That's how severe it was.
What's it like hearing those words, though, Lindsay? I mean, as much as you're in pain, what's it like hearing the words that you're going to lose your... At that stage, it was your foot, yeah?
Yeah. Look, I always just call it corporate mode. Like, let's get this done, let's get it over and done with, because I cannot live with this pain anymore. I want the pain gone, and whatever it takes, I want the pain gone. It is what it is. It's one of those things, you know, the whole thing for me last year was just a comedy of errors, you know, the worst comedy of errors ever. But, you know, not being able to get to a hospital, not getting a doctor to actually understand how much pain I'm in, realising when it was too late I could have seen my Chinese practitioner as an emergency patient. You know, it was just all wrong, you know.
Once the drugs wore off in hospital, how was that in terms of sort of waking up? So you woke up and you're on pretty serious drugs for quite a few days. And once that's taken away from you, what's the realisation like that you've had part of your body taken away?
I still haven't realised that.
Well, it's pretty recent.
And it was. I was fine. I wasn't feeling any pain. I knew that life would never be the same again, you know, being cliche, but, you know, that's it. And life isn't the same, you know, simply rolling over in bed, getting out of bed, you know, all these things that once upon a time you just do, you know, and it's not until you lose a leg, you think, oh, God, oh, hang on a minute. No, I don't have that leg anymore. Got laughing again and sort of looked around and thought, hey, you know, it's not that bad. And yeah, it is, you know, I don't know how other amputees feel or how they go through it. You know, and you do. You get a little bit glum.
Well, you'd be feeling sorry for yourself, surely, at some stage.
No, it's not so much. No, I don't feel sorry for myself. Like, I'm still here. You learn a lot about the health services in Victoria. There are some absolutely wonderful people out there, but the rest of them are just bloody money grabbers. You know, the first thing you're asked is, do you have an NDIS package? And my response now is, what difference does that make? You know, because do you discriminate? There's discrimination, which I totally understand. But because I've only lost one limb, there are people that have lost two limbs or, you know, different circumstances that are put, you know, further up the ladder than me. Yeah, sometimes you go, oh, yeah, you know, I want this done now. But then you think, well, no, you know, these people. So there's a lot of this. I get a rage. I'm full of rage. And I'm sure other people have gone through this. You just get so angry that you can't do things, you know.
So what's daily life look like for you now? Because I know you're doing a lot of rehab. You're learning to negotiate life with a new body.
Yeah, well, it's pretty bloody tough, actually, some days, because every day, every minute of every day, I have to think differently about what I'm doing.
You're going to have to undo, you know, 60 odd years of learning.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I say to people, I have to learn to unwalk because, you know, first day on the prosthetic, I just got up and bolted. You know, I thought, wow. Gemma said to me, said, Lindsay, you can slow down because I'm used to, you know, running around. I lived in town for like 5 years. So you get used to that dodging and, you know. Yeah, and I just, oh, right. And then when she said that, I thought, oh, my God, and I started to feel dizzy and my brain is in, you know, it goes into total overload. It's like a computer, you know, reboot and say, right, you've lost a leg. This is the prosthetic. I have a mantra when I'm walking, you know, trust the leg, because it feels so different because there's no flexibility. Just sort of adjust, you know, you just do your best.
Well, you kind of have to, I guess, don't you?
Yeah,
no real alternative.
No.
Tell me about Lindsay's future. Like, have you got some aspirations or you're
no.
you're so busy with the rehab and getting to know your new body? Are you going to write about this? Because I know we didn't really touch on the fact that you'd like to write, but I could see an autobiography out of this at some stage.
God, you know. Yeah, Lisa. Like, you know, I've written about 7 novels. I actually have notebooks in every cupboard with, you know, various stories and the beginnings of novels and ends of novels and what have you. And a friend of mine said to me on Boxing Day, he said, listen, you know, this stump can make you a lot of money. You know,
I'm like, yeah. Monetize it.
And, you know, do some stand-up. You know, I'm like, you know, I just don't, I'm not even thinking like that. So I don't know. I want to get my leg. I want to get back in my car. My, you know, Karen Kona, I want to get back in her. I want to do day trips like I used to do and just sort of get back out there and do something, you know, like do something. And learning what I've learned through this, there's a lot of things that need addressing. And I'm not the person to take it on because really now I just couldn't be bothered. You know,
yeah.
I sort of, you know, I think I've served my time like community-wise. I don't know, something needs to be done with you know, people with prosthetics, people that even on Facebook, I see these horrific tales, you know, from the NDIS page. Of what carers have done, and you know, it needs shaking up anyway.
Well,
I just don't know.
I'm gonna let's sign off. I could talk to you all day, of course, especially about historical queer Melbourne and that sort of thing. But the two words that have come to mind today as we've been talking are rebel and Survivor. And I think they both cover you really well.
Oh, thank you.
You've got an amazing sense of social justice. You've been an incredible contributor to the queer community. And we, you know, I talked about things in the intro about, you know, Bent TV, Joy, Pride March, emceeing Pride March,
the stage.
You've done so much. People would know you. People will listen to this and know your voice. They'll know your face. We can just put a photo of Stumpy up if you want.
Oh, yeah, fair enough. Right. I want to have Lady Stump.
Yeah, that's the nickname I noticed.
Yeah, yeah. And you know that song from the city, you know, Lady Bump, yeah. You know.
You've still got your sense of humour, which is amazing. You're an absolute survivor. Mm. And, I just wanted to thank you for, A, coming in here, but also for everything you've done.
Oh, thank
and,
you.
And just being an amazing rebel and survivor along the way.
So oh, thank
thanks
you.
Thanks for coming in, Lindsay.
Well, thank you.
And good luck with everything.
Yeah.
I know you're going to be fine.
Oh, thank you. I hope so.
No, you will. I just know you will. You've got that kind of personality
Schutzpah.
That you'll just go, well, this is a bit shit, but let's get on with it.
But, you know, I've got an awful lot to thank the community for as well, you know, especially, you know, like during the amputee period. But, you know, before that, actually watching Bent TV and the Bake Off and stuff like that that I've done and the amount of support that I've felt, you know, throughout my time in the community. You know, I call myself the luckiest lesbian in Melbourne, really.
Yeah, so a lot of it has come back to you, but you were a massive...
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Lindsay.
You're more than welcome.
Cheers. This episode is now available for download as a podcast. You can find this episode and the entire back catalogue of Word for Word episodes across the seasons on iTunes and Spotify, or download directly from the Joy website, joy.org.au. While you're at it, head over to the Word for Word Facebook page to keep up to date with news and episodes. Joy Podcasts, where you want them, when you want them.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Lisa Daniel from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 stations across the community radio network.
Join the knitting circle. just child chat. Why don't you want oven chips now? It's a Tokyo bouncy ball, it's an Oslo bouncy ball, it's a Rio de Janeiro bouncy ball. Filter, I love these mighty oaks, don't you? Do everything and feel nothing, wristband, theme park, scratch card, lanyard. Do everything and feel nothing. Do everything and feel nothing.